This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Hello, how are you? I hope you're all safe and well. From time to time, we stray slightly from our regular broadcasting. Today, we've got something from the Value Perspective, part of the Schroders Podcast Network. They're a team of fund managers who speak to people from all walks of life about probability and dealing with solutions to complex problems under immense pressure. They've spoken to gamblers, army sergeants, Arctic explorers, a film director, as well as investors. However, if you've ever wondered or were ever intrigued or have ever been frustrated trying to figure out how to value investments, then this podcast might be the one for you. It's with Aswath Damodaran. He's a professor of finance at the Stern School of Business at New York University, where he teaches corporate finance and equity valuation. He's a great orator. He speaks fascinatingly about all manner of subjects, from valuing Tesla to the probability of Brazil winning the Football World Cup. It's a great listen. There are some technical terms in there, which our colleague Emily Corvo takes you through briefly before the podcast begins. Juan Torres Rodriguez is your host. So grab a cuppa, lean back into Juan's and Aswath's silky tones, and enjoy. And we'll be back next week.
Before we start with today's episode, Juan and Aswath are going to discuss two concepts which you may not be familiar with, so we like to give you some quick definitions to help out. They'll talk about debt ratio for a bit, which is a financial ratio that measures the extent of a company's leverage, and it can be basically interpreted as the proportion of a company's assets that are financed by debt. Secondly, Juan will reference Monte Carlo simulations that was used in his past life as an investment banker. A Monte Carlo simulation is used to model the probability of different outcomes in a process that can't be easily predicted due to a lot of random variables. It's a technique used to understand the impact of risk and uncertainty in prediction and forecasting models. Now on with the episode.
In today's episode, we have Professor Aswath Damodaran. He's a professor of finance at the Stern School of Business at New York University, where he teaches corporate finance and equity valuation. An eminence in the world of academic finance, Professor Damodaran is sometimes referred to as the Dean of Valuation, given his expertise on the subject. He is the author of several books, including Valuation and Narrative and Numbers, The Value of Stories in Business. He's also the author behind the well-known blog, Musing on Markets. In today's episode, we cover topics around how to best avoid taking shortcuts in valuations, data management to make better decisions, valuation as a craft, use of probabilities, and the power of narrative. We hope you enjoy it. Professor, thank you very much for your time and for joining us in the Value Perspective podcast. It's such an honor to have you here. Maybe for those that might not know who you are and in the world of finance, I don't think that there are that many. Maybe would it be possible for you to give us a little bit of background on yourself and sure. How you came to teach valuation and write so many of the books that are the driving course for many people in the industry?
I'll give you my informal bio. I mean, I grew up in India. I got my undergraduate degree in India, master's in India, that came out to the US to get an MBA and PhD at UCLA. It was 1984 when I graduated with my PhD. I spent a couple of years teaching at UC Berkeley before coming to New York in 1986. I came to NYU in 1986, and I tell a story which kind of is the lead-in to why I teach what I teach right now, which is when I came to NYU, I was given a class to teach. It was called Security Analysis. It's a class that Ben Graham taught at Columbia in the 1950s that no Warren Buffett took. And they gave me the class, and I took one look and said, I don't want to teach this class, most boring class ever, because by 1986, this is a collection of topics. There's almost nothing on valuation. There was like one session where you did the stable growth dividend discount model. It's like Ben Graham's security analysis still being taught in 1986. So I went to the head of my department. I said, you know what? I'd like to teach a valuation class. And he said, don't do it. And he said, there isn't enough stuff in valuation to actually fill a class. And you know what? He was absolutely right. There wasn't enough stuff in valuation. There were no books on valuation, unless you wanted to go back to Ben Graham's Security Analysis, which was written in 1934. And there were no real papers and research on valuation. Data is very difficult to get on valuation. But I really wanted to teach this class. And I learned very early in my academic life that if you want to get something done, the best way to do it is to do it subversively. So I said, I'll teach a security analysis class. And I walked in and taught a valuation class. That was the fall of 1986. This year, I'm teaching valuation to two sessions, and it'll be my 58th and 59th semester teaching valuation. And I tell people something about this class that's going to encapsulate how I think about valuation. Everything I know about valuation, I've learned in the course of teaching this class. Everything I've gone through has been a learning experience, whether it was the 1987 flash crash, where on October 19th of 1987, stocks dropped 22%. The S&P 500 dropped 22% in one day. The 1990s with the dot-com boom was a learning experience about how to value. Everything I know about valuing young companies, I learned in the process of valuing Amazon, which is an online book retailer in 1997. I learned about how banks going under can affect every company through the 2008 crisis. And I learned how to value users and subscribers and platforms because of all those companies that went public in the last decade. I didn't come into teaching valuation fully formed with all the views I have. And that's something to remember about valuation. It's a craft. You keep working at it. So the first, it's like cooking. The first time you cook, you cook the only thing you know, which might be eggs. But as you cook, you expand your arsenal. But if you say, look, I'm a really good egg cooker and that's all I'll keep cooking, you get really good at cooking eggs, but that's it. Valuation, you got to keep the door open. You're never going to master this. You just keep working at your craft. And if you ask me to describe myself, that's what I do. I work at my craft. I enjoy valuation. I'm not an expert. I'm not a researcher. I don't write for academic journals. I basically do valuation because I'm interested in it. I keep learning new things every time I value a company. Now, and as I've done this, if you ask me to describe myself as a person, I'm a teacher. At the forefront of all my descriptions. Everything else I do is secondary to it. I don't consult. I don't work or sit on boards. I don't do any of the stuff that is potentially easier money, but because I don't enjoy it, I teach. And since I'm teaching something that's always in the moment, valuation is never boring. That's the one thing about valuation. There's always something going on that you don't understand, that you have to try to get your hands around. It's like waking up to a new lab experiment every day. It says GameStop 3 weeks ago, zoomed up and zoomed down. It was a learning experience about, hey, what is it that drives price and why is price different from value? So it's not a conventional bio, but that's the way I think of myself. I'm a teacher. I've learned in the process of teaching. I teach valuation and corporate finance. That's the other top, the two big courses I teach. And the difference between the two is in corporate finance, you look at value from the inside out as a manager. What can I do to change the value? In valuation, you look at the same company from the outside in. It kind of teaches humility as an investor not to change things that you shouldn't be messing with. So when I see an analyst valuing a company, working at a mutual fund, valuing a company, changing the debt ratio to target debt ratio, question I ask is, who do you think you are? Yeah. What makes you think you can change the debt ratio? It's something that because I teach both classes, I have to recognize where the line stops as a passive investor and where the line begins as a manager. So hopefully that's enough of an intro for me. So as I said, valuation covers pretty much everything in business and finance. So we can roam wherever we want to roam.
That's really interesting. Thank you very much for that. I guess this is a question that you get asked a lot, but is there a way to enforce discipline when doing valuations in a way that will limit or even better stop people from taking shortcuts while valuing a company? And maybe a checklist, or I know that in the past you've developed some app tools that maybe those could work as a way to cross-check that your numbers are sensible.
I think there are two things. One is No, you can't check a valuation for correctness. Why? Because we don't know what the future will bring. The future is going to bring its own surprises. Valuations are going to be wrong 100% of the time. So it'd be hubris on my part to look at your valuation and say your valuation is wrong. But here's what I can do. I can look at your valuation and check for what I call internal consistency. In other words, I can tell you whether you're at war with yourself. Not with me, but with yourself. And I'll give you a simple example. Let's suppose you sit down to value a company. You put in a high growth rate. Why? Because you like the company, you like the market. You also give it high margins, the margins increasing over time. So, okay. Usually when you want to grow your revenues, you got to sell more. But in this case, not only are you selling more, you're raising prices as you do. So I'm going to push back and say, well, what kind of competition do you face? Are you the sole player where you have complete pricing power? And if you haven't even thought about that answer, I'm going to say, well, I don't know whether I can buy into this story because you've told me a story, but I haven't checked the competition. Is this a market where companies have pricing power? And then I get beyond your growth and margins if you tell me a convincing story and I look at what you're setting aside to create the growth. Growth is not magical. It doesn't happen on its own. Now, the way you showed an evaluation, you might have line item out of line item, CapEx, depreciation, working capital, acquisition. But the net effect is it's taking away from earnings and reducing your cash flows. It's reinvestment. I'm going to look at that collective reinvestment and say, you told me a story about high growth, but I'm looking at your reinvestment and it doesn't look like you're reinvesting any money. Tell me again what this company has done. And maybe you have a convincing story. It's an infrastructure company. It's already invested in the infrastructure. Therefore, it doesn't need fresh reinvestment. But there, if you don't have an answer, I'm going to say maybe you need to think about the fact that your story is a growth story, but your reinvestment reflects a very different company. If you have a multiple personality company wandering through your valuation, in other words, it's a growth company in your revenues, it's a company with no competition in its margins, it's a company which doesn't reinvest money, but behaves like a mature company in the reinvestment, then you have to make up your mind, which of these three personalities do you want to latch yourself onto? And make a valuation that's consistent. So I think that checking for consistency is very simple. You can build into any spreadsheet you have, and I won't impose one on you, but if whatever spreadsheet you use, I just run a simple worksheet of what am I assuming about growth, what am I assuming about margins, what am I assuming about reinvestment in one page, and it just jumps out at me and says, look, you know, those numbers don't go together. I need to revisit those numbers. Which brings me to my second point. Your biggest enemy in valuation looks at you in the mirror every morning when you get up and brush your teeth. And the biggest problems in valuation are not mechanical. They're human.
Yeah.
And in fact, I call this the Bermuda Triangle of valuation. They're the three biggest dangers to valuation. The first is bias and preconceptions. When you sit down to value a company, you bring your preconceptions in. The stronger those preconceptions and biases are, the less point there is to doing valuation. So if you brought me in front of an M&A banking analyst team at an investment bank that teaches them valuation, I'm going to tell you it's pointless. The problem here is not that they don't know how to value companies. There's too much bias in the process. Why? Because you make money as a banker from deals going through. And for deals to go through, your value has to be high. So you already start with that. Hey, I have to end up with a high value. Otherwise, I don't get paid. I can teach you everything there is to teach about how to come up with discount rates, how to bring in country risk, how to incorporate cash flows, but it doesn't matter because you're going to find a way to get to that high value.
So, but that's an interesting point. So, but how do you fight against that human bias? You want to do it like in the proper way.
First, don't create processes that add to the bias. The biggest problem in the M&A process is the deal maker is the deal analyst. You got a conflict of interest right there. That's not pre-written. Why does the investment banker who actually does my deal, why is that investment banker being asked, does this deal make sense? In fact, I say this facetiously in my class, asking a banker, an M&A banker, whether a deal makes sense is like asking a plastic surgeon whether there's something wrong with your face. What kind of answer are you going to get? So first, we need to separate deal analysis from deal making. The appraiser who tells me whether a deal makes sense, can make no money on the deal because then I've loaded up the dice. So first we need to take the process out. In equity research, I tell people subtle things you do create bias. You're a portfolio manager. You call in your buy side analysts and you give them a mission. You say, look, I want you to value this company. And then as a throwaway, you say, well, you know what? We happen to own 1 million shares in this company. You might not mean for that to create bias, but it is going to create bias. Because he knows or she knows what will make you happy. Coming back and telling you, this is a great company, you should continue to hold it. And whether you like it. So I tell people, be careful, subtle messages you send, things you say that you don't even realize you're saying, can create bias. So if you want to minimize bias, try to kind of give people as clean a slate as possible. They'll still bring their own biases based on their priors. But the only way to expose that is A, for them to be open about their biases, and B, for somebody to push back and ask, well, you've assumed this high growth rate. So there's got to be almost a devil's advocate in the room, somebody who's not just asking mechanical numbers, but understands enough about the company that they can push back and say, hey, you're assuming $600 billion in revenues for Tesla in year 10. The largest automobile company in the world, Volkswagen, is $300 billion in revenues. Where's the extra $300 billion coming from? And if they say software, you know that they haven't thought through this. The largest software company in the world, Microsoft, makes $130 billion revenues. You don't make $300 billion in revenues in software. But sometimes just putting people on the spot and saying, and focus on the year 10 numbers. Don't ask about year one. Year one's too easy, right? Because then they can say, well, this is what they did. Focus on the year 10 numbers and say, you created this magical company in year 10 with $600 billion in revenues, 20% margins, and a return on capital of 50%. Tell me about that company. What's got to be true about the world for Tesla? You know what's imputed in Tesla's market cap now is almost $750 billion in revenues, which would make them 2.5 times, it'll make them the largest company in the world in terms of revenues, 2.5 times larger than Volkswagen, the largest auto company. Margins of about 20%, which would make them like Microsoft, like software margins. So even if your story is about they're selling software, they almost all of the revenues have to come from software-like products. Your Tesla's got to be primarily software. And very little reinvestment. They're managing to produce, 4 million cars with very little assembly plant. How is that happening? And so I think that's when you start thinking about where is the story going? What kind of story would I need to justify it? And if you're a good analyst, you've thought through those stories. And I think that's why it's good to have meetings where people put out their ideas and then other people don't push back on mechanics because that's the wrong fight. But they push back on the story and the story's connection to the numbers.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to The Investor Download.
Professor, this is a podcast about getting better in decision-making, in part to become better investors, but also to help us make better decisions in life, in general. In your book, Narrative and Numbers, you make the point that data is central to making good decisions, but not just data, but good data management. Can you please walk us through what that means and also the risk of not managing data sets correctly, especially when it comes to valuing a business and in the context of investing?
Data keeps us disciplined, right? Because without data, we tell fairy tales. So that's the example I gave of Tesla. The reason I was able to push back on the Tesla valuation is I know what the revenues of a Volkswagen look like. And I don't know that instinctively, I had to look it up. It didn't take a lot of time. The advantage we have today is nobody has the excuse of saying that's too much work. It took me all of 1.5 minutes on Capital IQ to download the revenues of the top 25 automobile companies. So getting data is easy, but here's the downside of having so much data. If you don't know what you're looking for, you're going to drown in data. I call this the Google search problem. Google search, if you go in and type the name of a company, say, I'm going to find out more about the company, I promise you, you're going to enter a nightmare because you're going to get 67,000 hits on your company and you're going to get big stories, small stories, non-stories, rumors, tweets, all kinds of crap about your company. So I tell people, before you look at the data, have focus. You need to know what you're looking for before you go looking for it. So I take people through a reading of a 10K, for instance. Mm-hmm. I'll give it to say, give you or a prospectus. To give you some perspective, a typical prospectus now is 300 pages. Mm-hmm. A typical 10K can be 200 pages. You start on page one and you work all the way through page 300. You're lost completely because, you know, it's all kinds of stuff coming at you, some useful, some not. So I actually take people through a prospectus where I say, here are the things I need to know. I need to know about your growth. I need to know about your profitability. I need to know about your business model to answer the first two. And then know how you create growth. What do you invest in to create growth? Those are the questions I need to answer. Now I'm going to go looking at the 10K with each of the questions. So for growth, rather than look at the entire 10K, I'm looking at where are the parts of the 10K. Obviously, when I look at the financial statements and I look at the revenues and I look at revenues over the last 4 years, I'm getting a measure of whatever growth story is there and what you've actually grown at. So that's a number. I will also look at the footnotes and where you're getting your revenues. Maybe you're growing in India, not in the US. Why does it matter? I mean, if you take Netflix, the growth in users for Netflix in the last year or two has come primarily from India. You're saying, so what? Well, Indian subscribers are given this option of watching Netflix for $3 a month on their phones. And that actually makes a difference, because when Netflix says the number of subscribers has gone from 150 million to 165 million, market celebrate, right? 10% growth in subscribers. But what Netflix is forgetting to mention is those 15 million subscribers are not paying $15 a month, like in the US, or $12 a month, like in Europe. They're paying $3 a month. That's data, but that's data that is there, but it can get lost because you're just reading it from page one to 300. You just skip over those parts. So my suggestion with data is have focus, know what you're looking for. Knowing what to throw away is actually more important than knowing what to look for, because, you know, out of the 300 pages of a 10K, I use probably 12 to 15 pages, to be quite honest. And after a while, I'll tell you entire sections of the 10K that are completely useless, that you might as well skip over. Like what? That entire section on risk in every 10K, with like 30 pages of this could happen. It's written by lawyers, four lawyers. Obviously, it's written to make sure that they never get sued. But I've never read a risk section in either prospectus or a 10K that's ever helped me. Because it really tells me nothing. It says the competition could get stronger, our margins could get lower. Thank you for letting me know. I would never have thought of that on my own. But there are entire, so I think people assume that just, you know, the words I used to describe is, don't mistake data for information. What we're looking for is information. We have to wade through a lot of data to find that information. And that's basically what you will learn. And that's what I mean by a craft, is you don't learn it by my talking about it. You learn it as you value companies. You learn that these are the parts that seem to matter. The next time I read a 10K, I'm going to go to those parts first. Like somebody actually talked to me once about automating this, where they said, if we can watch you read 10Ks over and over again, we learn what you're looking at. We can actually then automate that and give it to you as an app, where you hit the app, it goes to those sections of the 10K. But I don't need an app. I can do that on my own. But you can think of doing that over time. Train yourself to figure out where you get information and what the distractions are. Because you'll have a lot of shiny baubles distracting you, saying, look at me, look at me. And if you look at them, you're going to get lost very quickly.
Could be the case that for many companies, it's the case that a section like risks in the 10K is not going to tell you something. But then there is this one company where there might be this one bullet point where actually there's a meaningful risk in the form of a contingency, maybe, that it's not that pronounced, that you should be right. Careful, that could drive your valuation down.
Yeah, I think that's true. There is this risk that if you're too sloppy, you could miss something significant. But usually when it's something like that, it's usually in the footnotes. And I do read the footnotes. I browse through the footnotes, because often things like contingent liabilities will not show up in the risk section. it'll show up as a footnote, which is, oh, by the way, we forgot to mention we have these purchase commitments for the next 5 years, which are $12 billion, where we have no way of backing out of these commitments. No. And I think one of the problems with the accounting disclosure requirements is, I keep telling accountants, and they keep refusing to listen to me, is less is more. Because they think the answer to everything is disclosure. Just disclose it. Just disclose it. Add more stuff. Now, that's one reason I'm cynical on this ESG disclosure stuff that's coming out. I guarantee it's going to add 50 pages to every 10K on carbon emissions and this. And, you know, and the problem is it's 50 pages, not 2 pages. I would much rather have a more focused disclosure of what your ESG risks are than this 50-page novel on this could be there. You're mixing the big stuff with the small stuff. In the process, you're actually making it less likely that I'll even read any of that stuff. So I do read I do browse the footnotes, but that doesn't take time. The big time is actually that narrative that management has devised for the first 150 pages. Because you don't actually get to the financial statements till almost page 200 of a 300-page 10K, or even page 240. And almost everything you need will be in those last 60 pages. Yeah. And I think that if you do find something or question, sometimes I will go back to the first pages looking. And that's a nice thing about having a PDF version that I like, is kind of do a search. Yeah. I can do a search of the page, whereas in the old days, I used to actually have to leaf through page after page. So if I find a mention of some special management option agreement, like on Tesla telling Elon Musk, you get 10 million shares if the stock price hits something, and I read that in the footnotes, and I'm worried about it, I'll go back and look for it in the earlier section, see if there's something else I've mentioned.
That's very interesting. And actually, continuing with the topic of narratives, valuation is core to the investment process, yet at different points in history and today in some pockets of the market, one can hear people saying that valuations do not matter. And this is actually that probably we have seen many times before throughout many different cycles. And so this is something that keeps kind of repeating itself in history. So why do you think this happens? And why do you think that we haven't been able to, as investors, human beings, participants in the market, to learn from the mistakes of other generations? And this just keeps happening. Is this the power of narrative in action? Is this like its dark side?
Well, I think in a sense, first, where most of us are not investors, we're traders. And for a trader, it's always true. Valuations don't matter. Trading is about buying low, selling high. It's about mood and momentum. And they're absolutely right. You can get very rich being a trader, right? I mean, if you hit the market at the right time and you leave the market at the right time. So this is not new. It's always been the case. But for a market to be healthy, you need both investors and traders. Now, much as investors look down on traders and view them as short term. And let's face it, without traders, investors would have a really tough time. There'd be no liquidity in the market. And without investors, traders very quickly get lost. There'd be no magnet drawing it in. The way I think about markets is these groups ebb and flow. There are times when investors are too many in number and there aren't enough traders. And these are markets where the trading dries up, often bear markets, you know, everything is undervalued. But remember, as an investor, you want the price to adjust to value. And without the traders in there, you don't get that correction that'll give you the returns. And then you look at other times where the traders have taken over and the investors are on the sidelines. They're saying, I can't explain that. Everything looks overvalued to me. And I don't think either end game is healthy, but markets self-correct. And what leads to self-correction is trading at some point in time. Traders' view is, if I perceive it to be worth 1,000, what difference does it make what the earnings and the cash flows are? Now, that reasoning works if you have a Picasso. A Picasso is all perception. There's no underlying cash flows. So we could keep bidding up Picassos as long as there's somebody wealthier enough to be willing to pay the higher price. But if the company, there are earnings and cash flows. You and I can convince ourselves that Tesla is worth $1 trillion. But if they can't sell the cars and they can't get revenues even close to $200 billion, let alone $600 billion, the truth eventually comes out, which effectively means at that point in time, you don't even need investors. The traders themselves will wake up and say, oh my God, the same mood that pushed the price up will push the price down. Look at how quickly GameStop got pushed up and got pushed down. The mood shifted essentially like watching a manic depressive in action. So I think that that ultimately, I don't get frustrated by this. I find a lot of investors get frustrated when traders have taken over the market and Bitcoin is up at 50,000, Tesla's up at 900. And you say, what the heck do I do? People have gone crazy. It's not your problem. You invest based on the cash flows. What does it matter to you that other people, I think part of this is envy, which is other people are making money so easily. I am working so hard. I deserve to make the money. They don't. And that is at the root of a lot of problems in value investing, is people get righteous and then they double down. I've seen it happen for the last 10 years. Value investors getting mad at the rest of the market because it's rewarding all these shallow traders and it's not rewarding them for doing the work. And they say, that's a recipe for disaster. No. So if you don't want to buy Bitcoin at 50,000, don't buy Bitcoin at 50,000. You don't want to buy Tesla at 900, don't buy Tesla at 900. Don't sit there pointing your finger at those people. That's a bubble. Those people are crazy. It's not your money. If you can find something else in the market, that is a fair value for you, go out and buy it. But it's not your job to go around wagging your finger at other people saying you shouldn't be doing that. That's too much. You're in a bubble. You're a speculator. It's not your money. Let them do what they want to with their money and let the game play out.
It's interesting. In one of the emails that we exchanged, I mentioned a piece by Morgan Housel that he wrote very recently called "The Best Story Wins." I don't know if you read it.
Yeah, I read it. Yeah, Morgan's a great. In fact, I really like his new book. It's a great way to think about the philosophical foundations of what exactly you're trying to do as an investor.
Small paragraphs that caught my attention. I'm just going to read them out loud.
Right.
Because he was saying, a truth that applies to many fields, which can frustrate some as much as it energizes others, is that the person who tells the most compelling story wins. Not who has the best idea or the right answer, just whoever tells a story that catches people's attention and gets them to nod their heads. And then a little bit farther down, he actually said that John Burr Williams had more profound insight on the topic of valuing companies than Benjamin Graham, but Graham knew how to write a good paragraph, so he became the legend. And I was wondering if, I mean, you've mentioned in the past that words have consequences and can shape a company's valuation, at least in the short term, because of the words or the narrative that is built around the company, how that company is being described and how description can be the driver to the valuation. Mm-hmm. Is there too much noise in the ecosystem? And isn't this a way that markets have always worked?
I think the truth is markets over time have always had narratives drive prices. And I think the one thing that the last 20 years have brought, and I'm going to borrow another concept from another great mind, George Soros and reflexivity, where you tell a big story, the big story can actually make it easier for you to deliver on the story. I mean, the reason is very simple. Make the story bigger, your price gets pushed up, you go out and raise equity at that price, you've now got the cash, you can now try to make, so there's a feedback loop here. And it's something I wrote about in the context of GameStop, because in the context of GameStop, people said when the stock goes to 20 to 400, does the company gain anything from that 20-fold increase in the price? So I actually wrote about three effects, but there's a feedback. The first is the perception effect, which is if you're a banker who's lend money to GameStop, even if nothing has changed, that 20-fold increase in the price, you lean back and you heave a sigh of relief. Now, I'm not going to put any pressure on them. I feel a little better today than I did yesterday. The second is if you're GameStop going out to hire a new CEO or a new top manager, your life just got a little easier at $400 price than a $20 price, because you can offer them this carrot of, hey, you want no options. Who wants an option in a $10 stock that's dropped 50%? No. So those are the implicit effects. There's an explicit effect. In the case of AMC, when the stock price went up, because people are telling this big story, their convertible debt got converted. So all of a sudden, their debt burden became smaller, their distress went down. So there's a fundamental change in the business. And there's actually a third component. This is where it gets tricky. Now, AMC actually filed with the SEC to issue shares on December 11th. They had incredible foresight. So when their price went up, they could have issued shares at a higher price, collected the cash. And in these days where everybody has a SPAC, think of this as AMC with a SPAC, and the SPAC can be used for them to enter new businesses. So I make this big deal about price and value being different processes, but I also talk about the feedback loop between price and value. So when you have a really big storyteller, and the last 20 years, that's what Silicon Valley has trained founders to be, go tell a really big story. The way this shows up is the total accessible market you talk about is always trillions, not billions. Because you'll say, this is a really big story. Look how big my story is. And then use that story. You don't have to be specific. People will then give you a high price based on the story. Use that high pricing to then make yourself the lead player in that story. And with the networking benefits that come with technology, your story has now led to actual fundamentals that back up that story. And it clearly worked with an Uber. I mean, if you think about the getting, it's clearly worked with an Airbnb. So everybody thinks that this is their pathway to success. The only problem is there's only so much room in the world for lots of big stories, right? There's only so much money we collectively as consumers have to spend. And that's when the tension kicks in, is if too many people are telling big stories, we're building what I call the big market delusion. Each story by itself is plausible, but the collection of stories is a fairy tale.
Get in touch with us by email at schroederspodcasts@schroeders.com or visit our website, schroeders.com/investor download.
I guess the other issue with that is that there is a lot of survival chip bias, in the sense that we tend to remember those stories and great narratives that actually work through, but no one remembers all of the dot-coms that actually didn't make it through the late 1990s.
At the end. When you write the end of the story, that's going to be true, but there are going to be points in the story. We have all these collections of implausible, basically these big stories all coexisting. So that's a big market delusion, as I'm saying, that could last a time. So if you're waiting for that end game to play out as an investor, which is what you're doing when you're selling short on an Uber, saying this story sounds too big, you might be right in the end game. But remember the old Keynesian saying, if you know, we're all dead in the long term. And some of these stories, by the time that uncertainty gets resolved and you're writing the history of gaming companies or AI companies or ride-sharing companies, you might say these were the two winners and this is what led them there, but there were five of them at some point in time with market caps that were unsustainable, and it took almost 15 years for Didi and Grab and Ola and Uber and Lyft to all reach that steady state. So you're right, in the long term, the truth wins out. And as an investor, that's a challenge. How long is the long term? When will, and the problem is we're hitting these stories so early in the process that the resolution might not be till 25 years from now. This is not like the 1980s, where the public, young public companies you were investing in were not, you know, in chapter one, they were in chapter 12 of a 35 chapter book. Microsoft, by the time it got public, had an operating system, was making revenue, was actually generating profits. Apple, by the time it went public, had the first computer out there. Today, we're getting companies go public with a concept and an idea. And a business. I mean, let's face it, Uber doesn't have a business model that works still. The sense of making money. And it's because of that, we're hitting these companies early, and as public investors, it exposes us to a much greater time period before the story resolves.
My next question, which is one of the topics that we've been exploring quite often in the podcast, is how to think about probabilities and how to best use probabilities in a way that informs your decision-making and your investment process. And so And we are kind of interested in understanding, how do you think of and apply probabilities in the context of valuing a business on, or investing in a specific security? And in our recent session and in your book, you talk about the 3Ps framework, which I thought was quite interesting. Maybe you can explain that to us. And how do you go about best estimate this new need to build into, to cross-check how the narrative plays out with the real life numbers?
Yeah. I like simple processes. And one of the things I try to do is create a framework where I can keep myself honest, because I have bias like everybody else. I love companies, I hate companies, and those biases feed out. So when I tell a story, I say, look, the best way for me to make sure the story I've told is not a fairy tale is to take it through the 3P test. First test, is it possible? It's a very simple test. I want to make sure that I haven't told you a story where my market share becomes more than 100% or my return on capital becomes 5,000%. So that's a relatively straightforward part. Is it possible? Then I look at, is it plausible? Plausible basically means somebody somewhere has done something like this, right? So basically, when I tell a story about I can do this, I can do this. Oh, by the way, Amazon did something like this in this business. So if it's Airbnb and I talk about expanding the hospitality market, I can point to Uber and say Uber tripled the car service market. It's plausible. Then comes the toughest test, probability. Now I'm trying to take this and say, how will it play out? So here I want something more specific. Show me a particular, even if it's a market test, that in a particular market, what you were able to charge as a price, what you were able to generate as a margin, possible, plausible, probable. Now, and I like to use a Latin American example of being in Brazil and asking this question 6 months before the 2018 World Cup. There were 300 Brazilians in the room, and I said, is it possible? This was 6 months before a World Cup, 2018. Is it possible that Brazil will win the World Cup? And what do you think the answer was? You asked 300 Brazilians 6 months before a World Cup, is it possible? I said, of course it is. We won it five times before. I said, is it plausible? And you know what? In 2017, they felt pretty good. But if I'd asked that same question in December of 2014, after the previous World Cup, where Brazil got that shellacking at the hands of Germany, that plausible might have been a little shaky. In 2017, they felt pretty good about it. Then I said, is it probable that Brazil won the World Cup? And then they looked at, you know, it depends on what group we get put at and whether Neymar stays healthy and if this and this happens. So with each one, I was upping the ante. People had to come up with more thinking. And when I listen to founder stories, my job often is to ask those questions that take the founder from what's possible to what's plausible to what's probable. And you'd be amazed at how many founder stories fail the test as you start to go from possible to plausible. You know, one of the things that I make my students in my valuation class do is watch Shark Tank. It's one of their assignments every week, is you have to watch at least one episode of Shark Tank. And with every person who comes and pitches, you've seen Shark Tank, right? People pitch business ideas.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
So you have to pick at least one of those stories and take it through this process. So it's something that makes them more disciplined in terms of, you know, what are the questions I need to ask for a story to make sense. And that's all you can do is ask those. And to make it more explicit, and you've probably seen this in my books or in my blogs, when I value a company, I actually try to get explicit about what I'm uncertain about. Revenue growth, oh, here's how uncertain I am. Margins, here's how uncertain I am. Putting in a distribution instead of a single number. Because what that allows me to do then is to run a Monte Carlo simulation. Sounds fancy, but basically it's more real. It allows for the fact that you don't control the world, that things can change and it'll play out as different values. It forces you to confront your own uncertainties and make them explicit. Okay.
So that's really interesting. When I was working back in corporate finance, IBD, about 10 years ago, I used to have this managing director that used to say that Monte Carlo simulations were not supposed to be used in every single valuation exercise for every single industry. You seem to use Monte Carlo simulations quite often to cross-check your numbers, or that's part of your valuation process. Do you think that that statement is correct, the fact that you shouldn't be using it? Does it work better for some industries and sectors rather than others? What do you think about it?
I think the key is when you do Monte Carlo simulation, you've got to put distributions on your assumption. To get distributions, you need data. And that's easier in some business. So if you gave me an oil company to value, Monte Carlo simulations are very easy to do. Why? Because the prime variable that you're uncertain about is the oil price. And the oil price is traded. So I can give you past prices. Getting a distribution is almost trivial there. It's already out there. In contrast, if you try a Monte Carlo simulation on a software company and you're uncertain about margins, there's no distribution, a market-traded distribution. I can give you the margins of different software companies, but you're trying to convert that into a distribution. So it's not that it's less applicable, but getting the data you need to put in the distributions for the variables that matter is more difficult in some businesses than others. But I just think that that's just a continuum. In some businesses, I think Monte Carlo simulations have more basis because you have more basis for the distributions. In others, it's more difficult.
Professor, we're coming to an end to our session, and we always ask our guests two questions towards the end. The first is, can you please give us an example of a decision that ended in a bad outcome because of bad process rather than bad luck?
I'll make it about an investment. Might as well be open about mistakes. I remember buying Vale in 2013. And I bought it because I called it my 3C bet, which is, I said, it was right at a time when the country was melting down. Brazil was starting to get into a political scandal. The commodity, iron ore, had dropped in price because China had pulled out of the market. So the country was in trouble, the commodity was in trouble, and the currency was in free fall. The real was dropping. So I valued Vale, and I came up with the value, I don't know, $14 per share, and the stock was trading at $9, and I bought the shares at $9, saying, I'm making a bet that since things are so bad, you're going to get a recovery on at least one of those dimensions, the markets. And I assumed that Vale's current earnings already reflected the fact that iron ore prices had dropped dramatically. I said, it's already in there, so it's all upside there. I sold the stock a year and a half later for $5 per share. And I wrote, I still remember the title of the post. I said, no mas. I give up. And I went through what I missed. And you know what I missed? I missed the fact that in commodity companies, it takes about 2 years for a drop in commodity prices to actually find their way into earnings, because many of them are forward and futures contracts. So what I thought was already the bottom in 2013 didn't really hit the bottom till 2000. So I was actually seeing that, not like iron ore prices continue to drop, but earnings continue to drop. And as I wrote that post, I said, you know what? I've learned a lesson. I've learned a lesson that with commodity companies, never take trailing 12-month numbers as your starting point, because they reflect a very different price than the price you're at today. It's like valuing an oil company in October of 2020 using 2019 numbers. I'll save you the trouble. Every oil company is going to look cheap. Why? Because 2019 oil prices were 20% higher, 40% higher than they were in 2020. So starting with the Vale valuation, I've learned to adjust my commodity company numbers. I actually restate the trailing numbers to reflect the current price. So that's the thing, is we all make mistakes. Now, I've made my share. What I try to do when I make a mistake is first be open about saying those words. You know what the words are? I was wrong. Because too many people make mistakes, and then I don't have the luxury, because everything I do is pretty much on my blog. I tell people when I buy, they tell me when I'm wrong. It's out there. And I often preempt them by saying I was wrong. But that's the first. The second is try to learn from your mistakes. I know this is, we talk, but I try to learn explicit lessons that I take into my next company like this one. When I valued Uber in 2013, and I've talked about this in the book, I screwed up. I screwed up because I took the existing car service market as my total accessible market. And Bill Gurley and I had this debate right after the 2013 valuation, where he pointed out that this could change the car service market, that this could become a much bigger market by attracting new users. And he was absolutely right. And I remember 2 years later, and I wrote about Uber and I revalued them. I said, I was wrong. And I know I was wrong because here's the tangible evidence. My mother, I thought Uber would attract people like my son and my niece, but my mother was taking Uber and she is a conservative South Indian. And I said, it's changed the market and I missed that. It's too late to go back and fix my 2013 valuation, but I valued Airbnb. I gave them a total accessible market, twice the size of the hotel market, because I think they are changing the hospitality business. But that's all you can do. And I'm still in the process, I think, of learning how to incorporate platforms fully into value. I don't think I'd do it
fully
yet. But I'm learning with each company that's platform-based. I'm learning about the things they can do and perhaps bring it more explicitly into my future valuations.
That's really interesting. And a book recommendation?
Well, Morgan Housel's book is, I would strongly recommend, if you've not read it, it's definitely a book you should read. Any book by Mike Mabuchin. Mike's a good friend of mine. He's somebody who bridges multiple disciplines. He's in psychology and statistics, but especially the book about luck versus skill, because I think every hedge fund manager who thinks he's the king of the universe should read that book, because what Mike points out very, very explicitly is how much of the investing game is luck and how little is skill.
Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to get in touch with us about anything on the show or give us ideas for future shows, you can email us at schroederspodcast@schroeders.com. If you want to listen to the Investor Downloads back catalogue, and why wouldn't you? You can go to schroeders.com/the Investor Download. Or rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Thursday and every other Monday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.